Today is the 20th of July 2012. My name is Therese Sweeney. This is the Pioneers of the Fringe project, the Green Valley leg of the project. Today I'm interviewing Cavill Farley at 70 Riverview Road, Pleasure Point, which is her home. And I'm just declaring at the start that I've known Cavill Farley probably for all of my life.
So, Cavill, what's your full name and date of birth and place?
Full name is Cavill Jean Farley. Date of birth, the 25th of the 1st, 1941. And I was born in Coffs Harbour, New South Wales.
What was your former name?
Cavill McHugh. And I had to always spell it. People would say, what is your name? And I'd say, Cavill McHugh. C-A-V-E-L-L-M-C-K-E-O-U-G-H. Yeah. That was growing up, yeah. Yeah.
Tell me your parents' full names.
My father was Charles Ralph McHugh and mum was Joan Cavill McHugh, yeah.
And do you have siblings?
Yes, I have a twin brother, Gary. Yes, Gary Jean, I'm Cavill Jean.
Wowee.
Yeah, very different for those times, I think. Mum stepped out of the box a bit, yeah.
So what do you mean by that?
Because Jean as Gary Jean was very different. It was G-E-N-E as in Jean Autry. And Cavill, well, I've only met one other Cavill. Well, I haven't actually met her, but I believe there was an elderly lady in Canada when I was travelling, and somebody said there was a lady living in that city that was named Cavill, but I've not ever met another Cavill.
It's a lovely name. Mm. What are the origins of, do you know the name?
Yes. In my grandfather's belongings after he died, and my grandmother's, there was a card with a photograph of Nurse Edith Cavill lying prone with her uniform on, being shot, stood over by a German soldier being shot. And she was a nurse in the war that helped prisoners of war escape in the hospital, from the hospital and escape. So they took her out and shot her. So I believe that's where Mum got the name as her second Christian name, and then that's how I got my Christian name, yes.
Did that influence your profession?
I'm pretty sure it must have. I wasn't aware of it, but I'm sure somebody must have told me that story over the years because I was always going to be a nurse, always. Yes.
What school did you go to up there?
I went to many and varied schools. I was born in Coffs Harbour. Then Mum and Dad, because the war years, 1941, they had to move away from the coast. So they moved to Wingham, just out of Taree, and that's where Dad grew up. That was his home. And from Taree, I moved to Armidale, started school in Armidale, was there for a couple of years. Then Dad and Mum moved back to Coffs Harbour, went to school again there. Then we moved to Maitland. Went to school, made my confirmation and First Communion there. Then to Cessnock. And then from Cessnock, I won a bursary in those days to go to boarding school at Lochinvar. So I went to Lochinvar for my first 2 years of high school. And then Mum and Dad moved to Manly, and I finished off my schooling at Stella Maris at Manly.
Wow.
So I often hear people being moved around and chopped and changed and how they deal with all these sort of things, but I coped and I made a couple of friends each time at a different school. I don't think I was traumatised by it at all or felt any the less because we moved and moved and moved.
Yeah. And what about your twin? Where was he in all of this?
He was with me, yeah. When I went to boarding school at Lochinvar, just outside of Maitland, Mum and Dad had taken on managing a pub up at Murrundi. So I went to boarding school and Gary stayed with close friends of theirs in Maitland. But that was only for, I think, 2 years. And then all of us moved down to Manly and lived over the shops in the Corso at Manly.
And how long were you in Manly?
Probably, I know I finished my schooling there, but I was only just 15 and started work there. And then I knew I wanted to do nursing, so I went and did my nursing training when I was 17. And so and I remember travelling back and forwards on the ferry to come backwards and forwards on my days off and that sort of thing. And then Mum and Dad bought a house at Carlton. So that was, yeah. So I was probably in Manly about 4 or 5 years.
How old were you
then? When we first went to Manly, I was, 14. I was must have been, I was in my only, my last year, so I was 14, 13, 14. And then, yeah, so I was 17, I went training, my nursing, couldn't get in till you were 17 in those days. So I had worked in between that. And we were still living at Manly probably for the first 2 years of my training, and then Mum and Dad lived at Carlton. So probably from, 13 to 19, yeah.
Did the training meet your expectations?
Oh, I don't know if I had any expectations in those days. It was just, I didn't know what to expect. I was pretty naive, I can remember we did a PTS, the preliminary training school. There were 64 of us from all over New South Wales, which was really lovely. So we met, how you form relationships with certain people and got together, and it was just interesting meeting country girls and other parts of the city that I'd never been to and all that sort of thing. And that was, and just living in a very disciplined environment in those days. You had to live in, you were only allowed out, I think it was 2 12 p.m. passes a fortnight and 1 1:30 p.m. passes a fortnight. Other than that, you were living in the nursing home. No men allowed inside. But it was a lovely environment, yeah. And I've still meet with three or four of my friends from that time. Now we meet about every 6 weeks for lunch. So yeah, we've maintained a really good strong relationship. Yeah.
And how can you talk about how you met John?
John went to school. My brother Gary went to school at Christian Brothers Manly. And John was going to school there at Manly. So they knew each other. And I remember one particular year, John was very involved with the surf club, and he was going up to Maroochydore to row in the surf club. But he had a part-time job because he was so tall. He'd walk around the Corso overnight and reach up and turn all the lights on in the shop front windows because they weren't automatic in those days. So when he was away, he asked Gary to do that for him, and Gary had to take a big long stick because Gary was just fairly short. So I shouldn't say that. I should say he was just a normal, but John was 6'3", so it was the difference. So then I got to know John, and we used to go to the CYO dances. And I went with Gary and John to a basketball game. And on the way home, sort of, they stopped off and had a couple of drinks. We were only talking about this the other night, what we used to drink in those days. You know, Bacardis and gin squashes and all those brandy, lime and sodas and all those sort of things. So that's one recollection. But we used to go to the dances, and we'd go to Narrabeen, we'd go to Pymble, we'd go to Chatswood. So one night we went to Narrabeen to the dance, and John said, could he take me home? We got the bus home. And then we went to the movies and sort of come home, went upstairs, and I thought, we'll sit down, have this nice big smooch on the lounge, and he went straight out to the kitchen and said, do you want a cup of tea? But that was the start of it all. So we were both about 19 at that time.
And what was John's full name and his date of birth and place?
John Terence Farley, the 14th of the 11th, 1940, and he was born in Manly, yeah. Yeah.
So when did John pass away?
In April, the 27th of April, 2003, yeah.
and we'll revisit that, but we'll just go on to, can we move to the wedding?
Yeah.
Because we'll just get a little bit of background, and yeah. I don't want to hurry you through, though, because I'm quite enjoying talking with you.
No, it was...
So was it a shotgun wedding card?
Yes. Yes, it was. It was. Yeah. No. Such memories. Those are. I can remember. I was ready to graduate. We'd had a big graduation ball from RPA. You had to be very formally dressed. I got this very special dress made. Had my hair all twisted up on my head with about 2,000 bobby pins in it. And I think it was at the Menzies Hotel in the city. Beautiful place, you know, just. So that was, and about a week later, 2 weeks later, I wasn't feeling very good. And I didn't think much about it, actually. So anyhow, it sort of persisted. And I went over to, at those times, you had to go to the local medical officer that looked after the nurses. So I went over there and he said, I think I could be pregnant. So he sent me over to Carillion Avenue to see an obstetrician. So I rolls up in my full nursing uniform, hat, you know, the whole thing, went in and saw him. He was the loveliest man. And said, yeah, you are pregnant, just pregnant. And so I sort of, I don't know, I deal with things as they have. I don't remember, I probably was in shock and that. But I always knew in my heart, and I have always believed, that everything is going to be all right. That seems to be my life's philosophy. You'll deal with it. It's okay. Everything's going to be all right. So, but the funny thing was, as I was leaving the doctor's, the lady that did the appointments bent over and said, "Next time, dear, I think you can just come in civvies. Don't wear your uniform." And I hadn't even thought of that. But I thought, okay, how do I tell John, you know? So I think I actually, isn't it terrible? I shouldn't remember distinctly, but I think I remember ringing him up that night because I couldn't get out. I couldn't go and visit him. So I rang him up and said, you know, can you come over and see me? We've got to talk about something. And in the process sort of said, you know, I'm pregnant. And he was just totally supportive. I think his life was blown apart. I mean, neither of us had any money or anything, but it was just a foregone conclusion that we would get married, however we chose to do it. Mum and Dad were pretty disappointed. I wasn't allowed to wear a long dress. So I wore a short white dress, but yeah,
you're always a good sort. So, you would have looked good in whatever.
Oh, and at the reception, before the reception, I got lockjaw. I couldn't move I think it was just the stress and the strain. I just finished all my exams and I found all this, and then we got married and I couldn't move my bottom drawer for the photos. It was sort of locked into place. So that was a little memory I have. And I remember arriving at the church at Carlton. We got married at Carlton and we were early. I was early and I wanted to go into the church and Dad kept saying, "You can't go in. You can't be there before John." So we had to go round and round the block quite a few times before it was okay for me to go in. And then I'm sort of starting to walk down the aisle and my face, I could feel my face starting to crumble. You know, I'm thinking... So I had to take a great big deep breath and walk down the aisle, and then we signed the signatures and everything was done, and John started to cry. And I said to him, you know, "Are you crying for the life you're leaving, or is this just emotional?" But it was just emotional, yeah. So from then on...
So tell me about the face crumbling. What was the feelings around that?
Oh, I think everything just caught up with me. It was just all the love and all the disappointment, I suppose, to my parents and the my friends were really supportive and his friends were really supportive, but just those times it wasn't done. It was frowned upon. And my mum was a mum that always thought, what will people think of me? So that was, I was sorry for having done that to them, but if we could have just, I suppose, eloped or gone away and got married, it would have been beautiful, but you had to fulfill all the protocol of those days, you know, so you had to have the rellos there and all that sort of thing, and yeah, but it, yeah. Always thought of my wedding day as, you know, being very grand and long dresses and all that sort of thing. But that wasn't the important thing then. It was just being together. We just wanted it over and done with and just start our new life together. Yeah.
Did you honeymoon?
Oh, yeah. We took a Halvorsen cruiser and went down, where is it? Not Broken Bay. Anyhow, round Sydney in one of the inlets there. And it teamed the night of our wedding. It was pouring. And my brother drove us down. And we, Bobbin Head, we had to pick it up. So we went down there and boarded it. And it was rocking and rocking and rocking. And it wasn't us, it was the boat.
No, I meant like with the signature who hadn't.
Yes. Oh, well, it was very interesting. We, you know, we took off all around Bobbin Head and down, and we had showers under waterfalls and cornflakes on the beach, and always had banana with our cornflakes. That was a tradition John and I started then. And yeah, it was, and then at one stage, one evening, the motor cut out, and John sort of hailed a passing boat of some sort or other, and we were going closer and closer to the shore or the rocks sort of thing, and so he had to go with this guy to get petrol or whatever had to be done. And I'm standing there in the cabin and the doors are flying open, things are falling out, and I'm standing there with my arms up and my feet, legs spread, trying to hold all the cupboards shut and feeling violently ill till he got back. But he did get back, so that was okay. But, yeah, oh, and there was another interesting story too. We went to, where's the very upmarket hotel at
Newport
or whatever. So we took the boat and tied up there and went in, and there wasn't many people in the dining room. It was very pucker, you know, very upmarket, and we weren't used to this.
Must have been Palm Beach, was it?
Something like that, yeah. And so we had lunch and John's having steak. I haven't a clue what I want. But I remember the waiter coming over and saying, would you like English mustard or seeded mustard, sir? And John sort of looked. I'll have the English mustard. Thank you so much. So then we toddled off and down to the boat, and the tide had gone out and the boat was sort of hanging on the pier, and because he'd tied it up so tight. So then we had to sort of wait and then eventually get it down. And
it's hard when you don't know boating, isn't it?
Yes. Don't know anything then.
No.
Yes, looking back, it feels as if, you know, we were just children. Yes.
So let's talk about where you're deciding about, like, housing.
Yes. Then we got a unit in Brighton, above the shops in Brighton Les Sands. And, well, I completed my nursing, finished that in the February. I was the first nurse that was allowed to get married, as far as I know, at RPA before graduating, because you weren't allowed to have married nurses in those days. So we were married in the November. I graduated in the February, and then we moved to the Brighton & Sands in the flat above the shops, and that's when Rhonda was born. While I was there in the June of 62, yeah. So then, John worked. He'd get the bus. Our windows, front windows, looked out over the Bay Street at Brighton. So I'd sort of look out the window. I could see the bus turning right at the end of Bay Street down near the beach. And I'd say, John, the bus is coming, the bus is coming, the bus is coming, because he always had trouble getting out of bed and getting ready. And then he'd race down the stairs and get the bus and go to work. Yeah, and he was working at, he did apprenticeship at the railways. He was a carriage builder, and he finished that off that year. And then, just trying to think where he worked after that. He eventually went to Johnson & Johnson and worked there for many years. Yeah. So.
Okay, so what was your address in Green Valley?
You're jumping. Yeah.
I know. Sorry.
It's okay. No, I could go on and on for ages, about.
What was your address in Green Valley?
Good question.
It was in Yalta Street.
Yeah, 33 Yalta Street, Sadlier.
So we'll say that again.
Yeah. 33 Yalta Street, Sadlier, yeah.
And when did you actually apply for housing?
I don't remember exactly. I can remember after we got married, John's mum in particular said, you should get your name down for a housing commission house because, you won't be able to afford anything else, which realistically we couldn't. We probably had our name down for 4 or 5 years. Because I'd had Rhonda, then Tony, then Denise, and before we went to Sadlier, So, and then we ended up in Sadlier in 1966.
So how was that process? Did you get to look at a house?
Oh, the first letter came to say that we'd been given a house at Mount Druitt. And as John was working at Botany, it was impossible. So we rang them or wrote to them or whatever we did and said it would be an impossible situation for John to travel from Mount Druitt to Botany to work. So then we got another letter saying, you've been given this house at Sadlier. This is your final choice. You can't, if you refuse this one, you're off the list. So we had no option. So I can remember driving out to see it, and we had known the area because one of John's close friends from Manly, he and his wife, Terry and Robin Mills, we'd been to visit them a few times, and they lived in the valley. And not in Sadlier, but we knew where we were going. So we drove out there, drove to Sadlier, and pulled up in front of this house. And I thought, oh, it looks so big. This is just amazing. And because we had been living in just a little unit and semi-detached place, and I thought, oh, this is a whole house. It was just, I thought it was great. Yeah. So,
bushy, wasn't it? You had a few little paths near you or little walkways?
Our street was just a normal suburban street. If you went down and parallel to our street, there was a couple of parks and that sort of thing. But initially it was just like the house next door was just in a row of fibro houses, a white fibro with a little porch at the front. And, yeah, so it, but to me, I thought this is it, this is great.
How many bedrooms?
It had three bedrooms. We added on one more, and we put in a swimming pool while we were there. Then we had another child while we were there, yeah.
So can you tell me your children's while we're here? We'll just get all their full names and if you remember their dates of birth, or have a go.
There's Rhonda. Rhonda Ann Cassellis now, Farley. What would you like? Farley, Rhonda Ann, Anthony John, Denise Suzanne, and Terry Jean. And then 15 years later, after we moved out from Sadlier, we had Kieran Margaret.
How did that happen? Same as the first time?
No. I think John and I had been through a lot of growing in relationships, and we were very involved in marriage, communication and all that sort of thing for many years. And we both decided that, okay, if we got pregnant, we got pregnant, and that was it. We used the Billings Natural Family Planning and were very aware of what was happening with my body and that sort of thing. And I always knew, and I always had a little inkling at the back of my head that I would have two children in my older life as I got older. And what happened was I fell pregnant, and John came to the doctor with me, and that was fine. And then 6 weeks later, I had a miscarriage, and I was devastated. And then we sort of said, whatever happens, happens. So then I became pregnant with Kieran. And, yeah.
How old were you then?
41, yeah.
Quite common these days.
Yeah, yeah. It wasn't then. No. And people sort of looked at you a bit askance and sort of said, oh, I thought you knew how you didn't have children these days or something like that. But most people were very supportive and wonderful to me. And, yeah, and she's been, well, all my family, all my kids are just wonderful. Love them to death.
So let's, so you were right, you knew the Millses, and they were living at Miller.
Miller.
Were they? Near Paul Monley,
so. Yes, up on the hill. Yeah, they live there. And, we knew them. And I think, you know, we arrived, and the first Sunday we went down to Mass, and Father Muldoon was there, and we went and introduced ourselves to him, and he took me over and introduced me to Kath Dove. And that was my first meeting of anybody. And then sort of, because Rhonda was, she was just over four, so she would have been wanting to go to school the next year, and that's when the notices sort of came out, and they just discussed at the church about starting the new school up at St. Therese. So I was at the first meeting for the parents of the children that wanted to start school that first year. Yeah.
So let's talk about your memories of that first meeting and how you were feeling and who was there, and you're all on the same page, probably, were you?
I think quite a few of the ladies there had been in the valley before myself. I was a newcomer sort of thing, so I really didn't know people. So I sort of just sat back and observed, and yeah, you know, people were friendly, people were welcoming, and just...
Who was leading the discussions?
I think, from my memory now, it was Barbara...
Kane.
Barbara Kane, I think. Well, at that stage, there wasn't any sort of official gathering. We had to sort of get that all together, the agenda together, and get that. But I can remember Barbara... And I think Kath Dove was, I can remember her, and Shirley Bartz, and Catherine Cairns, and Evie Jarrett, Nancy Morrissey. I'm sure we sort of all were there. I didn't really know them all that well then, but I sort of sat back and then gradually got enough...
Confidence,
to say my little bit if I wanted to and not. But a wonderful group of women. And that was our only outlet at that stage. I had the four children, and everybody else was in the same boat. So the only time we had any social gatherings was this once a month meeting, which was, we all revelled in, I think. Yeah, it was just great to be together and know that we didn't have to answer the beck and call of mum, mum, mum. It was nice. So that really was the only time we really initially got together until they started deciding to have fundraisers to start the school and the church and all that sort of thing. So then everybody was involved with all sorts of ideas and house parties and car rallies and walkathons and all sorts of things, and everybody bonded and got together and just worked really hard. But it was a joy to be together, and just the relationships were just amazing that we built up over those years, yeah, which still still are there. And even like our kids still maintain the bonds that they created in those years. They still have relationship with all those kids they started school with, and even if they don't see one another very often, somebody will say to me, like Evelyn will say, oh, how's Tony? Oh, he's great, Eb, so-and-so. And the contact is still maintained. Yeah.
Why do you think, like, in your own sort of understanding, like, how old were you when you moved there?
I would have been, 66? I would have been 24, 25. Yeah.
So can you describe, like, how did the bonds develop and endure? Like, what were the themes, I suppose?
Yeah, I think because we were all put down in a new neighbourhood. The neighbourhood that everybody else had grown up in was gone. They were moved out of that. So we were put into this environment that we had to create a neighbourhood for ourselves. And I think that was it, that because all our husbands worked, but we didn't have a lot of money, but all of us had a lot of children. And we all, that was a bonding, you know, we all knew where everybody else was coming from. We all could understand if there was problems with people, how we could support each other and help each other. And yet we could empathise and take on board what, we didn't make judgments about people. We accepted each other. I think that was the biggest thing. There was no backbiting or bitchiness or, oh, I suppose that's an over-exaggeration, of course, within. But no, not really. We accepted people for who we might have said, oh, did you see so-and-so, carrying on again. But we still accepted that person for who they were. And yeah.
So it was something about your values.
Yes, and probably yes, because it was all connected to the church and the school, because we were all belonging to that community of Catholics that came together every week and then carried that through to the school and wanted that same ethos for our children. That was another bonding thing, a very big, I suppose, part of the whole thing.
Was it exciting to think that you were starting a new school?
Oh, fantastic. I thought, we can design their uniforms. That was so exciting. And from what I can remember, and, you know, my memory isn't all that flash hot, but I can't remember any major bickering about, oh, it should be this or should. I think we sort of reached a consensus very easily about what we thought would be a good idea and then presented it to the nuns and went from there. But, yeah, I was so excited about that. I thought, this is just wonderful that I'm here and, you know,
Rhonda's
going to be in the first class at St. Therese, yeah.
So do you remember how was it worked out how the uniforms will be made? And
yeah, I can't remember exactly, but I know that Shirley Camden was a dressmaker, and that it was decided that she could do the uniforms, because the girls' uniforms was just a little simple little red and white check dress, and the boys were just the trousers and shirts. So Shirley did it for quite a long time, I think till it got too much for her, and then they put it out to be manufactured, you know, as a bulk thing. But that added to the part of neighbourliness and community that, you know, she was doing that, and it was helping them and it was helping the school, and was she was local. We could go and take the kids up there and get them measured and, yeah, the whole bit, yeah.
So did you take your kids up there?
I don't remember. I can't say I didn't. I can't say I didn't. I can't remember, but I assume I must have.
I think I have a vague, very vague memory of standing very still.
Yeah, yes. I'm assuming I would have.
Because
yes.
She lived on that road, yes. That really did divide, yes. was one of the boundaries, of course, yes. And it was, yes. Always, you saw the other landscape.
Yes, you did, on the
which
paddock.
Was the dairy.
Yes, yes, that's right.
Did you... So you were there in 66, so Miller Shops was built.
Miller Shops were there.
And did you
I used to do the shopping there. Yeah. Walk down, because we didn't have a car. And...
Well, they had delivery, didn't they? They delivered.
They did eventually. I don't know if it always delivered. They probably did. It was Franklin's then still. And I'd go down and do the shop. And I'm trying to think. I think I might have left it till Saturday mornings so John would be home with the kids, because I didn't really want to take 4 children shopping with me and go down Saturday mornings and do it. And probably got it delivered, yeah, because, yeah, it would have been too much to carry home, all that stuff. And I remember the trolleys loaded with the different, like Sadlier, Miller, you know, it was just on the trolleys, and they'd put your bag up on that, and then the man would come around with the truck and put it on your front steps, yes.
And Saturday would have been pretty hectic down there.
Oh, for sports and everything.
Well, just down in the shopping centre.
The shopping centre as well, yes, yes. Yeah, yes, it
You'd
was.
You'd be bumping into everybody, wouldn't you?
Not a lot. No.
You were focused.
Yeah. No, I can remember sailing around the trolley. I don't remember stopping and having... I don't think I had time to stop and chat. You know, I think it was just, hi, you know, move on. Yeah.
And what about Vince Stewart at the shoe shop?
I didn't have that relationship with... I probably got some shoes there, but I didn't. I know Evelyn and Nancy and all of those people know everybody that grew up in the valley and pick out these names and tell me, and I haven't got a clue, you know. I just, you know, I probably knew Vin. I probably said hi, you know, but I didn't really get into knowing people that well. I don't know whether I'm a little bit shy but I was more comfortable in growing relationships with the people I knew. I didn't really sort of go out of my way to...
It's hard work, isn't it? It takes a lot of time.
Well, it does, and you've got to have time.
Quality. You wanted quality.
I did, and I got quality, that's for sure. Yeah.
So who were some of your... Describe some of your dear friends and in the context of Green Valley, like... Who were some of your close friends?
Oh, well, Catherine Cairns and I were... Catherine and John, and John and I were very close. Evie and George, and Nancy and Tony, because they were always involved in the sports. There was, you know, they were running the boys' football or the girls' basketball or whatever. Shirley Barnes, of course, at the office. I didn't really know Frank all that well because he was pretty quiet and kept to himself fairly well, so I didn't know him all that well. And then Kath Dove, the other ladies like Kath Dove and Bess Wade, their children didn't actually go to the school, so I sort of had a different connection to them. I suppose with the people that you met every day, taking the kids down to school and dropping them off, and you'd say hello and carry on, and that sort of relationship built up a bit stronger.
So let's talk about that, when you would drop your kids off to the school, because the nuns talk about the laughter from the women.
I'm sure there was. I mean, I remember Rhonda started school, okay, so she was walking, Tony was walking, Denise was in the pram, and I was pregnant with Terry. So we'd walked, there was no question of getting car or bus, so you'd walk to the school, which, you know, really, these days, it's not far. And
well, you walked everywhere there, yeah, all the time,
yeah,
didn't you?
Yeah, that's right. And
no one had cars much.
No. Not very few of us had cars.
Their husbands had them at work.
Yes, yes. So, yeah, we'd well, of course we'd stake the time then to just have a chat and, yeah, tell the stories of what had happened the day before or whatever, and what are you doing next weekend? Are you going to the Barbara Cain's housewarming party or house party or whatever, or the wine tasting. There used to be quite a few wine tastings at the Monleys, which we thoroughly enjoyed.
Now tell me about what they were like.
Oh, fun. And you could get dressed up. I mean, you go out. Oh, yeah, I was just trying to think who...
I should do that to
everybody. Who was babysitting then. But I... John and Vonnie Newton's girls. They lived in the next street, and they'd come. There was three girls, but one of them would come around and babysit for us when these wine tastings and social things of an evening happened. So.
So were they like cocktail parties, or?
Yeah. It was like a cocktail. It was that. I forget the gentleman's name. He used to bring the wine. Had a. Liquor store. I'll think of it in a minute. He used to bring the wine, and then we'd all have a little taste of all the different wines and just see what we liked. And of course, we'd, you know, drink it down quite readily, and you know. But it was mainly conversation, and we'd bring a plate. Of course, you had to bring a plate. And
what would you bring? And what was the plate?
Oh, goodness knows. Jets crack. No, I can't. I think I'd probably bring something sweet, so probably a slice of some sort or something like that. And usually they were fundraisers too, and I'm not exactly sure. I think we paid to go, so that was the money raised went something for the school.
I mean, you might buy yes.
Wrong. Like, yeah, yes, you probably did, yeah.
Taste it
and say, yeah, I'll have one of those or two of those or
was
whatever.
Was there any dancing or music?
There was music, but at the wine night, no, there wasn't dancing. We just conversation, a lot of conversation.
What about Margaret Bonley? Were you close to Margaret or what? You knew Margaret.
I knew Margaret, and I considered myself a friend of Margaret's. Yeah, and I love Margaret. I thought she was just. A unique character. She just said it as it was, and I love that because that wasn't part of my agenda. You know, I found it difficult to sort of be that outspoken, and I'd sort of sometimes stand in awe and amazement at what she said. But she was such a warm, beautiful, amusing character. Yeah, just a lovely, lovely lady.
Outrageous.
Yeah. Hey, that's the word, exactly the word, outrageous. But so caring too in her own way and, yeah, just beautiful person. And Paul too. Paul, they were a couple. They were definitely a couple. You had to have Margaret and Paul. Yeah, and then Father Muldoon was hovering in the background.
So what were your impressions with Father Muldoon? And what did you think of him when you met him?
I thought he was a very trying to think of the word, not nice looking. He was just a.
He certainly had a presence.
He did. He had a presence. He was, and yet there was a vulnerability about him, and he was so gentle. He wasn't a ladies' man. He didn't find it easy to talk to the women. But John and he had a great relationship, and he was one of their mates. I don't think all the men considered him a mate. And when I had my miscarriage, he came up and put his arm around me, and it was just so meaningful for me for him to acknowledge that to me. But I thought he was just amazing.
Yeah. he evokes that, doesn't he?
It was certain. Certainly a big loss when he got ill and had to go. It was, you know, he just took a lot of the heart out of the place.
Do you want a minute or you're all right?
Yeah, it's okay.
No, I'm all right. You're
all right? Yeah, I'm fine.
I think it's good to capture the emotion.
Yeah.
I mean, an amazing man with children as well.
Yes, he had such care and concern for all the kids. And it was funny that, you know, that he couldn't really show his emotion that much to the ladies. But then I think that was his era as being a priesthood too, that, you know, you weren't. And he used to talk about that later on in his life, about how he had to sort of stand a couple of paces back from women because it wasn't the done thing, you know. But with children, he was just, yeah, so giving and so there for them. He's so present to them. Yeah, yeah.
So sensitive.
Yes, yes. So
emotional, really, in a
yeah.
very contained way.
Yes, yes, that too. Yeah. No, he was a lovely, lovely gentleman, a real gentleman, and a real pastor, a real father to the parish, yeah.
Just what the doctor ordered.
Yeah.
Amazing.
Yes. And then came in, the nuns came in and added a whole new dimension to the parish and their.
Do you remember the search for them? Were you around when he was?
No, I don't know. I just knew they'd arrived to take over the school when the children started. So, and just meeting Betty and Betty McMahon and the other sisters, and they were just so welcoming and so present to us and so joy-filled. They were, that you from the time, you know, it wasn't like an ordinary stilted academia type of school. It was just open arms, welcoming school from the first day. The kids were embraced. They were taken in for who they were and accepted for being little individuals in their own right. And it was a wonderful feeling in that school. Beautiful feeling. Yeah.
So did you have a favourite nun?
I love Betty. And Betty and I always got on really well. I love Sister Flippo. She taught Tony, and she was such an individual person. She was, before her time, I think, she was a beautiful person. But they were all lovely. They were all lovely, yeah. And they just, each of them was different in their own, each in their own way, but they gave everything to that parish, I think. They just, it was their family and their life after, you know, they got established there and started the school, get it going. And we were saying, I've been to a play the other night with Evelyn and Nancy and Val Hood, and we were coming back past Roselands, and we were talking about the walkathon from Roselands to St. Therese School, and we were saying that just could not happen today. It wouldn't have been acceptable today that little primary school children would have walked that far. And yet it was just a huge occasion, yeah, and so supported by the whole community and the nuns and the old mother. I'm not sure of her name, Mother. And it wasn't free.
We
no.
know someone.
Yeah,
else.
She.
Are you right? Do you want to sit in the sun? You want to get over here?
No, I'm fine. And she was in her 80s, and she walked from Roselands with the children.
It wasn't Hillary?
No, I had it the other night.
I know Betty's mentioned
her. Mm.
But
it's in the books, and there's pictures in the books.
I remember the walkathon.
Yes.
You know,
oh, you would have.
Yeah, that's right. So they were all, and it was a big occasion.
Oh, it was huge. We're all into it. Yes, and all the men were, we had people all the way down from the school to Roselands being supportive, the supporters being there for the kids as they came past, giving out drinks and fruit or whatever, and if they sort of were getting tired, pick them up in the car and bring them back. And yeah, it was phenomenal. It was I don't ever remember what that raised, but it must have been a huge amount of money in those days. Yeah.
What about the balls? Now, I know it was decorated with Johnson & Johnson chucks.
Yes, it was. The ceiling. That? Yeah, I did that with Catherine and Evelyn and Margaret Monley. And
so tell me about the creative process in that.
Well, I don't know. It was obviously at one of these meetings that we decided we'd have a debutante's ball, and it rolled on from that. And somehow or other, the four of us were decided to be on the committee. So we came up with these great ideas of how we could make the hall look a bit better. And John had bought some of these rolls of chucks home that were discarded from Johnson & Johnson because they were variegated in colours or something or other. So we decided we'd get quite a few of those and swathe them over the ceiling so that it, like a canopy. And so we did it. We did it, and I think we got an old tree or a branch of a dried out tree and sprayed it with gold and put it in a beautiful pot, and that was the entry for when they came in. And we did a wonderful job. We did. It was absolutely amazing, you know. And I think, you know, for the Valley to have a debutante ball was just, you know, so unique and different. And yeah, it went extraordinarily well. Yes.
And you used to have balls yourselves, like you'd have little soirees in that hall?
Yeah, yes, we'd have dinners and different to raise mostly money raises, but dancing, cabarets and dinner dances and that sort of thing. I used to make my own dresses in those days. I made my dress for the ball, which I thought was beautiful, and I used to sew all the kids' clothes then and make my dresses. But yeah, they were great times. They were great times. We had a ball. I probably drank a little too much, and wine was the drink of choice for the ladies in those. So we'd get the big carafes, the 2-litre carafes, take them down, share them around. And the blokes had the beers.
You mean the flagons?
The flagons, exactly.
Don't dress it up.
Exactly, the flagons. It was always the flagons, yeah.
And was the Green Valley Hotel around?
Yeah, it was there, and John used to go every Friday night to the Green Valley Hotel. He'd sort of come home, and I'd be waiting, because he'd say, oh, I'll be home at 8:30, Cav, I'll be home at 8:30, and yeah. I suppose it closed at 10 in those days. And it would come half past 9, 9:15, you know. And, of course, I'd be, you know, a bit of a snit, you know, and say, where are you? Oh, well, Georgie Jarrett walked in late and we had to do another shout. I couldn't just walk out on him. Now, could I? I couldn't just walk out on him. Looking back, it must have been so great for the blokes to have that time to bond together for themselves, you know. They needed it as much as us women.
Well, they had their own stresses, didn't they?
Of course they did. And John used to work at Botany, and I was only thinking the other day, he used to get a lift with Paul McLean, Jimmy Camden, and Terry Mills. They'd pick John up in the car, and then I don't really know how they did it, but they dropped each other off or on the way so that they could get transport to their jobs, and they did that for quite a long time. It was great, you know. Everybody was there for each other, very much so.
What about your street? Your neighbours?
My street was renowned, I think, for the police used to be there quite a lot. We had interesting neighbours opposite, interesting neighbours next door. Had one lot of nice neighbours on one side, but on the other side there was always... Should I say?
Yeah, just be... I think so.
Yeah,
and... You're just describing your street.
Yes, and I think the specific occasion.
Because it was an eclectic mix of people.
Oh, very much so, yes. And...
tell me about across the street. Well, I can tell you about ours.
The husband was quite abusive and chased his wife around the front yard a couple of times. To the end, John went over and sort of said he'd punch him out if he heard him that way again. And
because domestic violence was a problem.
Yes.
I lived in our street as
yes,
well.
Yes, yeah. I think that was the only...
And alcohol, probably.
Like. Yeah, and yeah, alcohol. And people losing their jobs and not being able to pay their debts. I remember the Waltons man coming and one lady on the other side down a bit, and she had trouble keeping up the payments, and they'd repossess all the stuff they'd bought on time payment for the kids for Christmas before, and all that would go back, and yeah, that sort of thing. Yeah, I'd say there was a lot of sadness around and a lot of stress on a lot of the people there. But, you know, for me, I tried to just... I don't think I was unfriendly to people, but to people that I knew didn't like me, or you could tell that they had a problem with dealing with people, you just stayed away from them. And, you know, you were civil and courteous, but you didn't go out of your way to make friends with those people. Yeah. The people that had the problems with the payments and all that sort of stuff, their kids went to St. Therese too, and I remember being over there trying to help her out quite a few times. She was a lovely lady, but they had no idea about finances, just nothing. I think they had six children, yeah.
But, and what about the isolation there? Like, did you feel isolated?
Not really. I felt...
Did you have a telephone or was it a...
No, we...
Or a telephone box? Did you all...
Your telephone box halfway down the street. That's an interesting question because we didn't... We eventually got a car, I think, after we'd been there probably... 3 or 4 years or something. But until that time, like for Christmases and that, we'd get the train and the ferry to Manly to go to lunch with John's mum and dad. Then we'd come back to Carlton to my mum and dad. And then we'd bring kids and everything home on public transport. And it just seemed to... That was the way it was. I think that's... You just accepted that was life in those days. But then we got our station wagon. Of course, everybody could jump in that and the kids could all sleep in the back.
The Valiant?
Yeah.
The White Valiant?
Oh, good question. I
think it was.
Yeah, and I remember going, you know, taking the kids out and taking blankets and pillows and they'd sleep in the back of the station wagon and... You know, yeah, it was just everybody had that sort of a car, I think, then, eventually, when we could afford it, yeah.
And what sort of sports did your kids play?
Oh, well, Tony played football, rugby league, and cricket, I think. He played cricket for a little while, not for long. And Rhonda certainly did basketball. I think Denise did. I know Terry did tennis at the tennis courts up the road. But they were all involved in different sports over the years that they were there, yeah. And then they were involved in the teams from St. Therese. It was St. Therese, yeah, and Tony Morrissey and Nancy used to sort of look after all that. And
when did you go back to work?
In 1970, I went back to work when Terry was about 14 months old. I went to work night duty at Liverpool Hospital for 3 nights a week. So it worked out very well because John would be home from work. I'd leave at 11 or to get on duty at 11 p.m. Then I'd finish up at 7 a.m. and come home, and then he could go off to work. So we had no problems with having, you know, the kids minded or anything. It was just it worked very well. And then when eventually if they gave me extra days or anything, there was a young girl up the street that was 14. She didn't work, and I'd pay her to come down and just stay with the kids while I went and had a few hours sleep. Yeah.
And, of course, your work saw dramas and injuries.
Yes, I was working casualty and, as it was then, casualty and intensive care unit at Liverpool Hospital. Yes, and I was there when Evelyn's little boy came in. So hard. I didn't... You try to be professional and just, you know, but it's difficult to maintain that when your friend's little boy's there. Yeah. So I was, when I knew that Anthony was going to be in there and I knew I had to go on duty, and I thought in one way I didn't want to face it, and in the other way I wanted to be there for him and them. So, yeah. And then they transferred him out of Liverpool Hospital. Yeah. Very, very sad time for all of us. Yeah.
And what about Mick Sweeney? Did you see him in there?
Mick Sweeney came in after a car accident into the casualty and had with head injuries and multiple. I was the nurse then. I was, you know, there was so much going on that night in the hospital in casualty, and I just sort of looked after him as best I could. And he has since said that I saved his life, but I don't really think that was up to me. I think it was the doctors that were there with me. But, it was an experience to be there and just know that he was getting the best treatment was important for me too, yeah.
What other memories of hospital and casualty at Liverpool? You would have seen a bit of change there. What sort of hospital was it at that time?
It was fairly quiet. We'd have, you know, the ambulance had come into casualty, and we had a waiting room, but nothing to the extent that they talk about these days. And we had abusive people, and I've had overdoses and throwing vomit bowls at me and all that sort of stuff. But we didn't have security in those days. I suppose with everything else, you just dealt with it the best way you could. The ambulance guys, they just dropped their patient off and go. You didn't have ambulances hanging around outside. It was just, you know, you take over and bring them in and then you transfer them up to the wards. But it was a mixed lot of happenings, but I don't think to the extent of it. It's certainly much, much bigger and more intense now. Yeah.
Did you enjoy your nursing there?
I love nursing. Yeah, I did. I hated going on night duty. I hated having to get up and go. And even now, when I go up and get into my bed, I say, thank you, God. Thank you. I don't have to go on duty. And Kieran has been doing night duty for the last week or so, and I empathise so much with her having to go, you know, go to work at 11 o'clock in the night and work till 7 a.m. in the morning. Yeah.
She's asleep now.
No, she actually has been on 3 nights, and she had yesterday off, and she's on 7 o'clock this morning, so she's at work. Yes.
So can you talk about John and what sort of man John was?
Yeah, he was a wonderful guy. He was just, you know, we were so different in a lot of ways, but he always respected me for who I was and always showed his love for me, not in a great overt fashion, though I always remember from the time we started going out, we always held hands going down the street, and we always did it from then on. And, you know, it was just a thing. But he was always so stable, so supportive. And we went and did this marriage encounter weekend, which took over a whole part of our lives for many, many years. And at that stage, we'd been married 15 years, and I was thinking, you know, there must be more to this. Is this all there is to being married? There's got to be something more. I was getting a bit disillusioned, and John was staying late at work, and I'm thinking, I'm just at home, I'm just a housewife, am I living up to, and I join all these, you know, did book discussion things and trying to think I can sort of make myself more acceptable. So a friend of ours said, oh, you'd love this weekend. It's a marriage encounter weekend. It's all about communication and marriage. And that'd be great. And John sort of rolled his eyes and said, oh, well, you know. And they said, oh, there's a weekend on such and such a date. And he said, sorry, football, there's grand final on that weekend. We couldn't possibly go, so we didn't. And then
I remember who we supported. Who did we support?
Manly. It's still, we're very pro-Manly family here.
He
was busy that weekend. So they booked us on another weekend. And I had no idea what this weekend was about. I just knew it was communication in marriage. And then we'd had a little tiff about something, and because I used to be horrible. I used to sulk. You know, I was one of those people that John would say, what's the matter? And I'd say, nothing. Nobody gives you the book to read to say how to stay married or how to be married or how to grow in marriage or anything like that. But anyway, so we did this weekend. He came along reluctantly. We went down to Hunter's Hill. And there were some nuns there at the weekend. He said, well, this is about marriage. What are the nuns doing here, you know? Anyhow, we went in and this series of talks all about communication and self-worth and all that sort of thing. And from the Saturday morning, he was blown away. He couldn't believe this weekend. Especially the first few talks about self-worth and just God does not make junk and you are a worthwhile person. It just took over him.
It resonated.
Oh, so much so. And then to talk about marriage as a relationship that was the way to holiness. Like, you know, before that, church was one thing, marriage was another. This was amalgamating marriage into being all you need to be for your faith. Just be there for each other, and that's all God wants from you. That's your holiness, you know. I think we had so many eye openers that weekend. We came home and we got out of the car, and Tony said to John, "Dad, you look different." And that was just so mind-blowing. We wanted to be part of this, so we were for the next 30-odd years.
It's a huge commitment, isn't
it? And I'm still involved. I'm still helping, yeah.
Is that at Hunter's Hill?
No, now they've changed all the venues all over the place because of finances and that. Everything's getting so expensive. So now they have them up at the Mount Schoenstatt Retreat Centre.
So it's like you're living your spirituality.
You're putting each other first.
Oh, yeah.
That our relationship is top priority.
Talk a bit more about that.
You're given it step by step on the weekend. So you're sort of looking at yourself, how you are as an individual, and accepting yourself for who you are. Then accepting your relationship for what it is, and that the person you married is still that person, even though you've probably been disillusioned and disappointed in some aspects of marriage over the years, that person is still the same person. So to build the relationship by communicating, trying to communicate each day, and find out how the other person's feeling about things, and how share with them how you're feeling, and just build up so that the acceptance and respect and love is maintained. Because so many people say, oh, we grew apart. But if you work at that, you don't grow apart. Because even if you say, well, I'm not happy with this situation right now, at least you can discuss it and decide, okay, well, if it's not going to work, it's not going to work. But unless you keep that relationship growing and maintaining the communication, it just is a lost cause, really. It was just, and the people we met through that too, with all the same goals and ideals, have been wonderful over the years. And when John died, besides the Sadlier community giving me so much support, these people also gave me a hell of a lot of support. And it's just through the beautiful friendships I've made over the years with these people that I've been able to sort of just realise that I had 41 wonderful years that is such a blessing that so many other people can't say. And I've just got to move on to the next part of my life, which whatever it might be. So, yeah.
And what is that now, today?
Goodness knows. I'm still working.
That brings up some emotion for you.
No, I just... it's hard to know. I'm still working, but only part-time now, only a couple of days a week.
So you're working as a nurse?
No.
In marriage?
No, we haven't mentioned that John started his own business after he did the marriage encounter weekend.
Oh, yeah, all right. Okay.
He would not have even thought of going out on his own before marriage encounter. That was the catalyst that gave him the confidence to decide with a partner to go into business and manufacture aluminium windows and doors, because he had been working in that field for quite a few years after he'd left Johnson & Johnson. So he decided to go in and start the factory over at Kurrawee. So we were all involved in all the grown-up kids, and I went over, we made fly screens, we set it all up, gave out little leaflets and letterboxes and all that sort of stuff. So we built up True Blue Windows at Kurrawee. So that's been ongoing. And when John passed away, Paul, my son-in-law, had just previously, the year before, bought into the business from John's other partners. So it was Paul and Rhonda and John and I. So it worked out that Paul then was able to take over after John died and run the business, which he's done amazingly. And so I've been his partner, working with him in the business full time. And then just last Christmas, he bought me out. So Paul's running the business now. Yeah. So, but I'm still working over there 2 or 3 days a week. Yeah.
And how is the business?
Fantastic. Yeah. Got a very good reputation in the Shire. A lot of, most of our work is by word of mouth, and, builders come back also. It's been going over 30-odd years now, so it's got a good reputation, and it's doing well, yeah.
And John's not out keeping his eye on things.
Yes, we talk about him every second day, and the boys actually, that was a beautiful thing, John's funeral. I don't know if you remember, a couple of the boys that work at the factory are from Niue. An island off Fiji. It's one of the small islands Pacific Islands connected to New Zealand, have a lot to do, well, a lot of their relations.
No.
Not specifically, it's just Niue. I'd never heard of it till the boys started. And they, at John's funeral, they brought the wrap, their native I don't know what tapis is, the material that wrapped the bodies in, and they wrapped the coffin in that round John before the coffin went down into the ground. So one of those boys is still there, and Tony, another one of the guys, there's always been there, and he John, you know, he said, I can remember when I first went there for an interview. He was sent down from Centrelink and he said he'd been on drugs and he'd been alcoholic. And he said, John said, come out the back here, I want to talk to you. He went up the back and he said, now, you know you've been on drugs and I know you've been alcoholic, but I've got a really good mate that was alcoholic and he's fantastic bloke and I'm happy to give you a go. So Tony's been there ever since. And at John's funeral, he said to me, I want to meet Tony Morrissey. Because he's the reason I got the job. And he said, I want to meet this man. And as I said to Tony, you don't know who you touch in this life, but Tony's still working at True Blue Windows because John believed Tony Morrissey was a fantastic guy and he'd overcome alcoholism. And Tony's never forgotten that, never, yeah. So, yeah, we talk about John a lot and they did a little box after he died, a little plastic ceramic type box with a rolled cigarette in it and his tea bag from work and his tea cup and a photo. So it sits up on one of the shelves in the cupboard at work.
I remember the Marlboro. Was it the...
He initially he used to smoke the... Oh, those really deadly...
White Ox?
No. In a soft packet.
The Camels?
Camels.
Non-filter.
Yes. And then he went to the Rollies. Yeah, than he used to do.
No. Oh, the Winfield, probably.
Yeah. So.
Okay, well, that's something I didn't know about.
Yeah.
True Blue Windows.
True Blue Windows. Yes, still going.
Okay.
Mm. So, yes, he did well. He did well then. And, yeah, that's what I think. Coming from a housing commission house, we bought a investment house at Harris Street in the city when he had extra money and his partner wanted to buy another property, so they sort of had to split and take the equal amount. Yes, in Harris Street, and I've still got that. I'm renting that. So, I mean, from having that, this place, I mean, so never would have believed it if you told me back in that first time I was...
You'd be a landlord.
Yes, yes.
And a business owner.
Yes.
So when did you leave the valley and how was that?
John and I had been looking around for quite a while as the kids got older because in the valley, if they had friends to come, there's only one lounge room. You're sort of sitting there on top of each other. We sort of had to make our excuses and sort of sit out in the kitchen or something or other. So we'd sort of been looking around for something a little bit bigger. And we'd gone everywhere. We'd driven nothing, just... you know, relaxed, just if we saw something, we thought, anyhow, because John, working at Kirrawee, used to come past Heathcote Road all the time. So he had swung down here a couple of times and had a look, and he said, oh, there's a place going up for auction down on Riverview Road. And he said, I'll ring them and see how much they want. And he rang them, and I forget, they wanted $240,000 or $250,000. 240, I think. And he said, oh, forget it, you know. So after the auction, he rang the agent and said, how much did it go for? And he said they didn't get a bid. So we worked it out. I've still got all the paperwork in there, how he did the sums, what max we could afford. So we made that offer. And they rang back and said they'd take that as a down payment, but we'd have to pay the extra. And we said, no, that was it. So 2 weeks later, it was getting close to Christmas, they rang back and said, you can have it. It was about 30,000 less than what they were asking. Well, it was 190,000. I was just looking at the papers a minute ago. We paid for this place, and there was one up the road, went for 1.2 million. And it's just amazing. So we couldn't afford to live here now, but certainly can enjoy it. Yes.
We're going to finish up, but I wanted to just get your feelings about, and we spoke about it earlier, about, you know, how did you feel when you started reading, when you were in Green Valley around that time when, it was political, of course, but when you were reading the newspapers about how they were describing the people of Green Valley. What was your reaction to that? And your real experience?
Well, it was nothing like my real experience. The people that I had become involved with were genuine, real, caring, loving, considerate people, looking after each other's backs and supporting each other. Of course, I realised there were people in crisis in the valley, and as the people opposite me, you know, there were those people, but that wasn't the total. They didn't give both sides of the story. They didn't say there was a caring community in the valley. It was just put down as hoodlums and, you know, problem people. So that was disappointing, but it didn't affect us because we knew the truth, we knew what we were, and the kids used to get ribbed, I think, as they grew older and went out and said, oh, we come from Green Valley. They'd get a bit, but they all stuck together and stood up for it. And, you know, they maintained that it was a good place to grow up in. Yeah. And I don't think the fellow came into work the other day and he said, oh, you're Pear's mother, aren't you? And I said, Tony? He said, yeah, I used to play rugby with the Bulls. And he said, I come from the valley. And then there was, you know, they associate with the valley as a great place to grow up in, a lot of people. So, yeah, it had its detractors. But I think a lot of that was paper sensationalism. And, yeah, I have no regrets ever. I think it was just a hugely enriching place for our children to grow up in. Mm. I'm sure the others have told you about the ladies' nights out, the Christmas nights out. We'd go out and Margaret Taylor was the instigator and organiser of most of these. So we'd book at some special nightclubby place and go there for the night and play up and enjoy ourselves and then come back and Margaret Monley would swing on the swings outside the St. Therese School and the playground there and people would be laughing and the nuns would, this would be 2 o'clock in the morning, waking the nuns and being silly and Just every year there was something different. Every year there was, we went to Campbelltown once and we're sort of racing each other along the roads home and and we wouldn't dare tell our kids that we did these things. Us sane, sensible mothers just taking off and thinking, oh God, you know, and we'd had a few drinks in those days. It wasn't, you know, and I don't think we had seat belts or anything. It was just terrible.
It was a real humour, though, wasn't it?
Oh, yes.
Like, it was non-stop laughter.
Yes. Oh, yes. We loved it. It was just something really we'd all look forward to with this big Christmas night out. And yeah,
it was really honest when you think about how people relate to each other.
Yes.
And thinking about, like, there was, you were all very real with each other.
Yes, we were very real, and we'd have a joke at the other's expense, you know. We wouldn't, you know, oh, there's Bessie, look at Bessie's, you know,
or
Carmy's middle. Peddled her pants again. Poor old Carmy, she used to get carried away and she'd have little accidents every now and again.
Is that because she'd laugh too much?
Yes. But we were always, we were all, could say those things to each other in it. And just, yeah, those, it's like, the people that have gone, and we still, Evie says, oh, I went out to the cemetery today to see Anthony, and she said, I called in to see John O, he's all right, and then we called in to see Father Muldoon and Carmy and Joan Purcell, all the oldies, you know, they're all out there together, and, yeah, it's just like, it's just beautiful that, you know, we can do that, yeah. Margaret. Margaret, I forgot Margie Monley. Yeah, she's there. So we're all together still.